Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast. This is your host, Professor Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The future of law is being written, practiced, and experienced by people, but not only by people in a one lawyer at a time or one client at a time sense. The legal world is being built and rebuilt in institutions, organizations, and communities. And from time to time, the Future Law Podcast will take a deep dive into organizational cultures and social practices. This episode is part of one of those dives, a multi-part look at a major global law firm that has been recognized repeatedly for its global leadership and innovation across both North American and global markets. This is Orrick, Herrington, and Sutcliffe, usually known by the single name Orrick, after one of the firm's founding partners. Like the Orrick name, the Orrick firm has deep roots in California. Orrick traces its origins to a practice that opened in San Francisco in 1863, which makes it one of the oldest companies on the West Coast of the U.S. For many decades, Orrick was a rock-solid, highly regarded law firm located on San Francisco's Montgomery Street, sort of the Wall Street of mid-20th century California. Beginning in the late 1980s, as East Coast U.S. firms started to open offices in San Francisco, and as San Francisco firms started to look opportunistically at Silicon Valley to the south, Orrick started casting itself in a new and different light. The San Francisco legal community sat up and took notice when Orrick moved its San Francisco office to new innovative space, and noticed again when Orrick expanded its geographic footprint eastward to New York and then beyond. Today, Orrick is a genuinely global firm with more than 25 offices around the world, including offices in New York, Washington, D.C., Silicon Valley, and an unusual office in an unlikely location, Wheeling, West Virginia, in the heart of America's Appalachian Mountains, known today as Orrick's Global Operations and Innovation Center. Orrick doesn't represent all of big law, but it's a big name, big law player. What does all of this add up to? What do Orrick's efforts tell us about the future of law? In this episode, we'll focus on innovation at Orrick. What does that word mean to the law firm? How does the law firm practice innovation when it delivers legal services? How does it use innovation to help its clients and to stay in the top tier of big law firms? My guests are Wendy Curtis, Chief Innovation Officer of the firm, and Kate Orr, Orrick's Senior Innovation Counsel. Wendy Curtis and Kate Orr, welcome to the Future Law Podcast.
Thank you.
So excited to be here.
Yeah, no, this is fabulous. Wendy, let's start with you. So I know from some personal family history that the Orrick Law Firm, which is celebrated today as an industry leader in innovation, back in the 1960s and 1970s was an elite San Francisco law firm, but was known back then especially for its municipal bond practice. It was very highly regarded, but kind of doing its ordinary thing with lawyers in blue suits and gray suits. It couldn't be a more different in terms of its identity and presence in the market than the Orrick of today. So I wondered if you could talk us through briefly the transition process. What were the key events and markers of how Orrick took on this innovation-themed identity?
So by way of total transparency, for one of those decades, I wasn't alive, and the second decade I was born. So I can't speak too much firsthand experience, but what I can tell you is how and why we're here now. And we have a lot to be proud of at Orrick and a long history of things to be proud of. And one of the things that we really point to early in our history is the fact that as a bond firm, we helped fund the Golden Gate Bridge. And if you look at Wikipedia, at its completion in 1937, the Golden Gate Bridge was a suspension bridge considered to be an engineering marvel and the longest suspension bridge in place at the time. So why does that matter? Because we work with amazing clients who are disrupting the world. And if you listen, you know, we can talk about lawyers and there's all these things that are said about how, you know, we wear blue suits and we only have one answer. And all of that is true. But at the same time, we're working on some of the most interesting things that are happening in the world. And that drives you to think about who you are and how you deliver your services. And the second reason why is that we have extraordinary leaders who have said that transformation, better servicing our clients, and understanding the law of the future, the practice of the future, the lawyers of the future is core to who we are. And so for those two reasons, I think that's really how we have evolved to where we are today. And it's important to step back for a second. And often we say things about the profession, about our firms, about our colleagues, about why we aren't more innovative. But if you pull back or the layers of that onion or take a second, almost anybody in our profession right now is doing something disruptive. Either it's the nature of the work that they're doing, it's the client that they're working for, or it's the creative legal argument. And the more that you focus on that and not the kind of other things about the lawyer personality that can be perceived as an obstacle, but really focusing on the things that we do that we are excited about, what are why we get up in the morning to go to work. That's why I think we've had such an impact and why there's such a predominant culture of change at the firm. But one of my favorite things is my colleague Kate and I often don't agree. And so I hope in this conversation she'll challenge me and we'll have a little bit of debate and discourse, Kate. So what do you think I missed?
So I immediately went to the clients as well. I wouldn't have thought to have your brilliant Golden Gate Bridge analogy. That was brilliant. But I think being responsive to client demands and expectations, what their businesses are focused on and what they're sort of demanding of their own businesses, it naturally translates into how we want to operate.
So I'm a native of the San Francisco Bay Area. So I literally grew up around the Golden Gate Bridge. And what's interesting about that as a metaphor in some respects for contemporary practice is I think that the Golden Gate Bridge to San Franciscans doesn't tell a story of disruption or innovation or being bold. The Golden Gate Bridge tells a story of this incredibly impressive engineering feat that is rock solid and stable and durable. Major earthquakes come and go, and the Golden Gate Bridge is still there. They celebrated the anniversary of the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge, and they opened the bridge deck to pedestrians, and hundreds of thousands of people crowded onto the bridge and flattened the deck to the point that some people were worried that it might actually cause some damage or worse, collapse the bridge, but it held up. So what you've done is you've taken this icon of durability and transformed it via a different story into a metaphor for innovation and change. And so I guess the question for both of you is the role of stories and the role of storytelling and metaphors inside law firms and for law firm leaders and for teams within law firms, the stories that you tell yourselves about why you do what you're doing and how those stories within ORIC have changed over the time that you've both been at the firm. Right? So what's the difference today in the stories that ORIC tells about itself and innovation in particular, compared to the stories that you were circulating at the law firm when you both began your careers at the firm?
So I like to answer the part of the question that I like the best. So I'm going to do that best here. And I like to redefine the question, which I'm also going to do here. So the story that or the narrative that I'm glad that we as a profession are moving away from that I think was too predominant in the general discourse is the idea that innovation is simply about doing things cheaper. I think that is a fundamentally flawed focus. Innovation is doing things better. And if you simply talk about cheaper, we're actually working with a professor at UVA's business school to really understand the impact of our communications in a digital age. But if you talk about cheaper, you talk about disaggregating, and to many people, when you hear that, you're suggesting to them that what they've done for the course of their career didn't bring value. And that's not true. And cheaper isn't always better. It's really getting at, what do you as the lawyer do that you love the most, and how do you focus on that? And how are you kind of rowing in the boat together with your client to really be giving them what they want? There's all these studies that if there's a common purpose, everybody on the team performs at a higher level. And if you understand what it is that the client needs, then you're going to feel better about the work you do, including if you have to work on a weekend or stay up late. You know why you're doing those tasks. So I think as we've talked about innovation, as we listen to our clients more, it's really trying to understand what's most important and or what's the unmet need. And it's less about constantly talking about doing things for a lower cost.
And I would add, I'm a rule follower, so I'm going to answer that question head on from when I started at Oric till today. What we're talking about now that when I was a junior lawyer, we weren't, is how we do what we do. So when I started out, we would talk about what we were doing and the arguments we were making and the cases we were winning, but we spend a lot of time now really talking to each other and internally and thinking creatively and pushing hard on how we're doing that work and whether we could do that work differently or better, or should we be doing, a particular piece of that work. And that really translates to a lot of our clients. Like, do we really need to have NDAs? So really just pushing on hard on the how to find those opportunities to innovation. That's to innovate. That's something very different than when I was a junior lawyer.
So where did that come from? So there must have been some moments, some episodes, maybe some leaders, some managers or particular clients who pushed on this. So what were the moving pieces that set what sounds like a cultural shift, a significant cultural shift in motion?
I mean, I think Wendy touched on it and you just alluded to it. I would point to leadership. Mm-hmm. And the real focus, starting with, I know you've been to our Global Operations and Innovation Center.
I have.
So a real focus from leadership on how we're doing what we do and whether we could be doing it differently. And when you have that, when it's part of your core strategy, it just naturally sort of trickles down.
So where does the instinct for that come from? So you associate that with leadership, firm leadership. That makes perfect sense to me. Does somebody wake up in the middle of the night and say, we all need to be doing something different to be more effective with our clients and more successful as a firm? Was there pressure, competitive pressure? Was there urgency from clients? Was there a demand for new lawyers that you're recruiting into the firm to have different kinds of opportunities to thrive? I'm just assuming that it's a blend of themes and blend of trajectories. And I think as somebody who teaches leadership to law students now and have practice leadership in other settings, I'm always interested in how these different threads get woven together. It's not that the soup doesn't make itself. So they have to be woven together purposefully, and people have to be paying attention to where these different ideas and themes are coming from.
So I would say it's all of the things that you said, and it's the classic study of effective leadership. And that is not something that I say lightly. And we are, again, I think because this has been enumerated as one of the core prongs of our strategy, that is what has differentiated us. It is that important, it is articulated that way, and it is communicated in a way that applies to everyone. There's another more nuanced reason as well, and this is especially in the last few years. The composition of law firms and the composition of legal teams is changing dramatically, and there are lots of folks who didn't go to law school. And when you're in a group with everybody who looks and thinks and is trained just like you, you all think the same way. And that is a weakness. And so as you bring an engineer or a marketing professional or a statistician or a data scientist or, and you just keep going, a project manager, they will ask questions like, why do you do that? And there's this moment, I wish people could see my face, but everybody, all the lawyers are turning their head. Well, nope, we just always did it that way. And it's not a judgment. But when you have somebody who just is curious and hasn't done the things that you do in the ways that you've done them, they will take that pause and challenge the status quo. And that really disrupts how we do things. And then the more we integrate our clients, and you're hearing this theme, the better we understand what it is about what we're giving them that they value. And there's been a huge change in the clients. When we started practicing, your deliverable was a memo. You know, I can't think of a client right now that wants a memo, and maybe if you sent one, you might get fired. And so this idea of even what the client is asking for in the format in which they're receiving it has changed so dramatically that jolts you to ask, you know, what are we trying to achieve? And then you came to one of our hackathons, one of our design thinking sessions, and asking those crazy questions and making people come up with crazy ideas, again, just resets your frame of mind and gets you to see things differently. And what we've learned, and you are an example of this, is we bring outsiders.
Yep.
And that perspective is invaluable to challenge us and to, you know, lift the blinders. So I think all of these, one, a well-executed, well-communicated strategy by extraordinary leadership. Without that, it doesn't happen. Kind of the next layer down, then, this idea of having different perspectives and outsiders helping you really think about what it is that you're doing, and all the basic concepts of design thinking really have an impact.
And so you're saying you have to practice what you preach, and practice not just in the, you actually have to do it for clients, although that's obviously a key portion of it as well, but practice in the sense of rehearse. So that's part of what I took away from my visit to the center in Wheeling, West Virginia, is that was an exercise that was clearly part of reinforcing a culture of innovative thinking, but it wasn't an exercise where there was client stakes on the table during the exercise. It was simply an exercise. I don't mean simply to minimize it, but simply in the sense of purely an exercise to get people's intellectual and social juices flowing in productive ways. And then what you're saying is you have to do that on a regular basis to keep people animated in the right directions. The second piece, though, I want to put a punctuation mark by what you said about clients don't want memos. And if you send them a memo, you might get them fired. I have to say, personally, that's one of the most profound things I've heard on this podcast in a long time, because it's a memo. It's a message that I share with my students, not a message that Oryk says, but just my observation of the way law practice and client expectations have evolved. Law schools across the United States, you probably know this, still train first-year law students in the art of the traditional legal research memo that you both probably learned how to do when you were law students years ago. I learned how to do it when I was a law student a long time ago. My law school still does it in Pittsburgh with our first-year law students. And when they come to my classrooms in the upper level, I tell them that form of a document, those headings and the systematic organization, that's a good technique to remember, but the content is going to be completely different because no one has the time or patience on the client side to read that kind of work. It's not what they need. It doesn't help them solve problems, and they don't want to pay for it.
But you know what I will say? Because again, I hate to pile on the negative. I'm going to give you a positive.
Yes, that's excellent.
So, you know, you started with the question of storytelling. And if you look on any executive ed program at any major university right now, storytelling is part of that. And there are books, and it's a huge part of how we're thinking about communicating. And I often think about why lawyers can do so many different jobs. And one of them is learning to write the facts section of your brief. That is storytelling. It's picking the facts that matter and laying them out in a way that tells the story. And that is a gift that lawyers have that law schools teach. And it's being persuasive. And so there are things about the way that we teach lawyers to write that are invaluable, but the memo is not one of them.
But so it's a metacognitive skill, right? Because it's effective and important at many scales of the professional experience. It's important when you're collaborating with colleagues. It's important when you're collaborating with clients. It's important when you're managing and leading a complex global law firm. Let me transition the perspective a little bit to the fact that Oryk is a global enterprise. Started life in San Francisco, expanded to New York, major presence in Silicon Valley, but offices around the world. How do you sustain this culture of innovation across so many communities where legal education systems can be quite different. Cultures of the bar and legal practice can be quite different. Expectations around collaboration and client service might be related to what you experience in the US, but it will have their own local flavors as well. How do you keep an integrated culture flowing with so much difference inside the organization?
So I think that at this point, we also enjoy well-deserved brand recognition that innovation is core to our culture. And because of that, we have folks in the firm and who join the firm who that is very much how they think about their practice. And so we have this critical mass that then draws additional talent and additional people who prioritize this in their practice. But the way that we think about it and the kind of recognition that we get is not the same across every office. And the way that Auric has structured this, and I think it's critical, is we don't have heavy bureaucracy in how we approach innovation. So we do try to track what people are working on so that we can connect people who are thinking about similar ideas, and so that you don't have folks kind of sitting in the corner on their own, not realizing that somebody else is thinking about the same idea or has tried it in the past. But you don't have to get approval to start incubating an idea. And we often, you know, joke that we have 1,000 seeds across the firm percolating, and some make it, you know, and make it through the soil. Some make it all the way up to a flower, and some actually get cut and put in a vase. And some of them, you know, never quite make it. But encouraging everybody to think about it and make it specific to them. And so tell us what the problem is. Tell us where you think we can do better. Share a client observation. And then we bring the power of the process. But I think there's a misconception that because we have a centralized innovation team, we come up with all the ideas. We do not. Let me say again, all of the great success stories and all of the great brand recognition and all the awards that we've gotten, that is not the result of my brain or Kate's brain. That is the result of our colleagues. And then we just help bring those to life. And creating a place where people can try and fail and try and fail, or try and start and stop because they're busy with something else, right? Because we're a for-profit business and we're generating revenue. But we'll support you, and we'll support you where you are, is really a big part of why we've been so successful and why so many people are willing to try.
I also think sort of talking about having a global innovation focus, one of the ways that we're effective is really in focusing on messages that translate regardless of jurisdiction or bar or practice area. And those are meeting client demands and, you know, how to best service our clients and working at the top of your license. And the concept there is that this innovation is and change shouldn't be scary, because what we're really trying to empower everyone to do is what they went to law school to do, to work at the top of their license and to free them up from tasks or approaches or work that could be done by a different resource or enhanced by technology. And those two concepts of working at the top of your license and serving your clients and meeting their needs creatively really translate regardless of location and practice.
What have been the big obstacles or barriers to success in the innovation culture across the firm?
Oh, this will be good. Let's see if Kate just says me as a starting point. One of our biggest barriers has been you. Kate, let's hear what you got here. I'll take it. I'll take my lashes.
I won't spend time on what everyone knows are the traditional barriers. I mean, change is hard. Change management is hard. Lawyers are trained to only speak when they have the right answer, and innovating requires you to screw up and fail sometimes. I mean, we talk a lot about those. One of the barriers, and I'm sure Wendy's anticipating, that I think that we've overcome, but has been a struggle, is sort of the say yes mentality and having to be really thoughtful about our innovation. We can't do and change everything, nor should we. And so coming up with a process and a strategy to help guide us in how we innovate, we've done it. But there was a while where we were treading water a bit and saying yes to everything.
And another challenge, I think we're still growing in our own skills and sophistication. And as we are more mature in what we do, you have to give some, you can't assign resources to every idea. And we joke in the team because I wasn't as great about saying no to anything initially. And we did get a little underwater. But there's also sometimes an idea that starts is not going to solve the problem that it was created for, but it solves something entirely different. And so giving it enough life, enough water, right? If I only have 6 cups of water to spread across all my little germinating seeds, I have to be strategic, but giving it enough water to see if it's even going to break through that soil. And what we're seeing over and over again, and this is where it's so important of the client voice, especially with things with data, we did this analysis and look, it shows this, or it can predict this. Okay, maybe that's insightful, or maybe something you didn't really need data to do that. But if you just turn the dial a little bit, wow, look at this insight that we never were able to really see before. Or we didn't realize that there was an entire unmet need in our clients by just offering the self-service legal insight that the business can use without ever having to talk to a lawyer. That can be a game changer. And so it's this tension of at what point can you define what the value is of the idea and giving it enough time to figure out if it's actually solving a problem we didn't even realize we had or that the client had.
And sometimes letting it fail. So that right? That was something that I heard in Kate's description. And it's something that when I'm teaching my students really wrestle with, because I find that at least at my school, students coming into law school are expecting that their job is to find the right answer. And if they don't find the right answer, they have failed. And failure is a bad thing. Failure might cost you your job. Failure might cost you your career. Failure might lead to all kinds of things. So failure is a big no-no. And so I gently try to push back a little bit and say, in the right circumstances, with the right context, failure can be a great growth opportunity. Failure can be a great learning opportunity. You have to have the right context. You have to have the right support for those kinds of attitudes. But failure is an option, to coin a phrase, sometimes. And it sounds like that's part of what has been absorbed into the Oric practice.
I'd also like to see the law schools somehow tweak a little bit how we teach the Socratic method. So you want all of us to learn to think critically. That's so important. But depending on how it's delivered, you're taught that you shouldn't give an answer if it's not perfect. And you're taught that if you don't give the perfect answer, folks will think less of you. And in fact, in this process, you need to create an intellectually safe space to just have crazy ideas. And you saw us do this in the hackathon, like come up with something that's so implausible that any other idea will feel safe. And we need, there's something about how we teach our lawyers that I hope that as a profession, we can actually be on the tip of the spear in any organization that we're in saying, you know, come in and talk to me about what you're trying to do. Doesn't have to be perfect. Don't be afraid of how you phrase it. I'm going to help you with my critical thinking skills get to the bottom of what it is that you're trying to solve.
Let me ask something to follow on that about the education and training process. And again, without getting into anything confidential on the firm's part, but I'm wondering whether the Oric now actively recruits new lawyers or recruits lateral lawyers to join the firm who demonstrate some of these competencies or aptitudes in the areas of more fluid critical thinking skills, more innovative attitudes about novelty and experimentation and collaboration? Or do you take what you get out of the law schools, wherever they might be, whatever country you might be in, and believe that through your innovation programming and other techniques that you can train any lawyer who comes into the firm to become successful in these styles of practice?
So there's something, and there's an assumption embedded in the question that you only want people in the firm who think a certain way. So we're getting the, I think, the best talent because of our brand, and people who are drawn to that are coming to Oric. But I read a great paper by a out of one of the business schools yesterday, and it was a case study on Netflix, but not for why you think. So this business professor interviewed a bunch of folks trying to predict kind of the buying patterns for Netflix's new streaming offering and asked people to, you know, rate whether this these two statements applied to them. And the first statement was, if there's a new movie, I'm going to be the first one to go out and watch it. you know, is that you, yes or no, on a scale of 1 to 10? And the second question was, if there's a new movie, are you the last one to know about it? Yes or no, 1 to 10. So, of course, you can imagine then the study goes on and the people who say I'm the first one to know about the new movie are the first one to know and try everything new. And of course, you know, you're the one and you use them to drive behavior and get the word out. But that doesn't mean that the other person doesn't watch the movie, like the movie, or buy the movie. They may not be the first to buy, but they're an important customer base and they're an important part of your community. So you need a little of both. And so, yes, we love folks who think this way. Yes, it's core to our culture. Yes, we look for that. But we also have people who are not the first ones to take the risk, who don't always know what the new movies are. But you know what? They still watch them. They still try the new tech. They still come up with good ideas. They still listen to their clients. And it's some combination of both that's the magic.
How do you measure all of this? How do you evaluate whether it's working or not? Kate, what do you think?
That's a tough question. A lot of innovation is difficult to measure in the traditional ways of measuring success in a business. So, you know, the measuring the ROI, the return on investment. You know, if we launch an app out into the world, you know, we have the observatory where we're tracking hundreds of legal tools and it's publicly available online and we can see who's using it and we can measure the impact that it's having in the market with our clients because we can see who's interacting with it and what's coming to us from that. That's kind of the easy way of measuring it. The harder way of measuring it is, I think you kind of know it when you see it. it's a sounds like a bit of a cop-out, but like having this discussion and listening to Wendy articulate what we're doing and why we're doing it. I think the measurement of success to me is that it is clearly not just lipstick, that it is actually happening in every way we're doing things differently and are seen in the industry as a leader. That means we're doing something right.
Wendy, I'll give you the last word.
So going back to where I started with the Golden Gate Bridge.
I was going to do that too.
Kate and I are based in our DC office. And I'm proud to say that the DC office team helped with the funding of the new Metro line. And in our practice, we now use AI. In our firm, we now use AI. And I think the way we measure it is that we started and we helped build the largest suspension bridge in place at the time. We are hired to create the newest Metro line or to help fund the newest Metro line in DC. And we continue to do it in a better way, in a more creative way. And as long as we're continuing to build bridges, help with trains and all of the other things that we do in our sector strategy, I think it's working.
That's great. I'll just conclude the podcast with the same theme, which is that the Golden Gate Bridge is still there and it's still standing and it's still standing tall. And as everybody knows about the Golden Gate Bridge, it is perpetually in a state of being painted, right? They paint the bridge. There's a very distinctive tone. There's a very distinctive paint that is custom mixed to give it that particular orange color. And when they're done painting it, beginning to end, they go back and start over again, because that's exactly how long it takes for the one coat to wear to the point that they need to continue it. So there's a metaphor both in your connecting the bridge idea to the contemporary Metro practice and to the durability and the renewal of the resource and of the profession. So I think we should close the podcast there. It's been a fast 30 minutes. I want to thank both of you for joining me today on the Future Law Podcast. This has been a great way to reconnect after we met a couple of years ago in my visit to the Global Operations and Innovation Center in Wheeling, West Virginia. There'll be a future podcast episode of the Future Law Podcast where we'll be talking specifically with other folks about what's going on down at the GOIC and what that's contributed to the firm. But for now, thank you. And I want to wish you both the best of success going forward. It's a very exciting practice that you've built.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.